Good, thank you, Elizabeth. It's great, wasn't it, to hear each other singing? I love that. I like being, I used to be in one of these a cappella singing groups a few years ago, and it's a very spiritual experience somehow, just being amongst people who are singing harmony, and you get drawn into that space, and it was very much like that as Rebecca was leading us in worship, so it was great, really, really good. And hearing the talk about the gang show, I don't know whether this happens to you, but there are often little moments in my life where I sort of wander back into previous encounters or decades. Does that happen to you? Something just triggers something. So we went to see Bohemian Rhapsody last night, you know, the film on Queen. I don't know whether any of you have seen it. Anybody seen it? Yeah. Two of us. Good. So I will give it a plug then. But it just took me back because it's sort of the soundtrack to most of my life, really. All the various Queen songs, and you don't realise quite how many there are. And it's the sort of film that can't fail because it's got such a good soundtrack. And it tells the story of Queen leading up to the Live Aid concert in 1985 and their early beginnings. And it was just fascinating, sat in the cinema, just going through the years and thinking about what I was doing when I was 25 in 1985 and what I was doing, you know, in the 70s. And then this morning, when we were talking about the gang show, as a 10-year-old, I was in the local scout gang show down in Horsham in Sussex, performing on stage in our local theatre, which held about 600 people. And we opened the show. So myself and my best friend, Richard Harris at that time, and two or three other lads, one of whom, Simon, ended up flying with the Red Arrows or something like that, you know, amazing where he went. And we opened the show. And I'm sitting here listening to them talking about it, and the song just floods through my head, you know. 1970, let's go, let's go. That was the name of the gang show, let's go. 1970, the 1970 show. This is the night we've been waiting for. And off you go, you know. All of a sudden, I'm back on stage as a 10-year-old in that space. It's really weird what happens. And then we had the time of praying, didn't we? And thanks. And I'm thinking all of that stuff that's happened over the years, and all of us will have been in those little experiences that have shaped us. You know, partly I can stand here in front of you today because I stood in front of 600 people as a 10-year-old and got used to being in front of people. What little things have shaped your life that have made you the person that you are today, that enable you then to step into this new year and continue to grow and develop and become the person that God wants you to be? Because we don't stop growing and developing. You know, the following year, in 1971, you can now work out how old I am, can't you, if you do the maths, if you're interested. So in 1971, I wasn't doing the same things in the gang show because I was now 11. So I was doing more. I was in more numbers, you know, and just like Toby, you know, I had a solo. A couple of years later, I'm sat on the stage on one of these trendy little stalls with a microphone playing my guitar and singing one of the songs that was popular at that time that was in the charts. I grew and developed, and hopefully I continue to grow and develop. Pam's very hopeful that I'll continue to grow and develop. And hopefully that will happen to us in this year ahead. I wonder what it is that you're thinking about becoming. Who do you want to become in this coming year? I wonder what will shape you. I wonder what choices you will make that will enable you to become who God wants you to be. Very timely, I think, for us to be looking at Abraham as we think about Genesis. We continue our studies through the book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, and we get to this point of looking at this towering figure who transcends the three major world religions called Abraham on this, our first Sunday of the new year. Very, very timely. And the book of Genesis shifts from the early stories, from the creation, from Noah and the flood, and then the Tower of Babel, all the things that we've heard about over the few weeks, particularly over the autumn sort of series, and then gets to this pivotal point, really, where it changes direction slightly and now picks up the theme of this family that is going to become a nation under Abraham, this person that is chosen, who actually is just like you and me. You know, we put these people in the Bible on somewhat of a pedestal, don't we? Amazing men of faith. He's called a man of faith in Hebrews, you know, put in the list. But actually, he's as flawed and fallible as you and I are. He doesn't get it all right. He messes things up. He wrestles with God and what it means to follow God. There's lots of dynamics going on that put him, I think, very fairly and squarely in our space. So let's not put these people somewhere where they're distant from us. Let's try and step into their world. So Genesis chapter 12 is where we pick up, or where I want us to pick up, what's happening with Abraham as he hears from God. So Genesis chapter 12, the Lord said to Abraham, "Go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation." We're on verse 2 of chapter 12. "And I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So Abraham is being blessed so that he can be a blessing. Something that we can receive as his inheritance. That God blesses us, not so that we might just hide it away or contain it, but that we might give it out. That we might be channels of his blessing to the world around us. So our focus is going to shift over these next few weeks. The people that are going to follow this Sunday are going to pick up some of the details, which I'm very pleased about, because there's some quite tricky things that happen in Abraham's life, which will puzzle us and we'll have to wrestle with about what this means for us today. And how God works with Abraham, and some of those tricky things. So I'm very pleased that I'm just sort of opening those things up. I'm just going to lift the lid off the pots and give you a sniff of what's coming, and not try and explain the details of what this might mean or that might mean. We have some sagely scholars amongst us who are going to do that with you over the next few weeks. So no pressure, Mark and Mark, because I think you're two of the people that are probably in that sort of in that list, looking at some of those things. So what does this family look like? What does this nation look like as it starts? Here we go. Apologies for the chart. In some respects, it's a scan from my dictionary of the Bible, which I love because it gives you just enough information to. Do the sort of things I want to do this morning. And I couldn't find anything online that did it quite as well as this. So here's Abraham's dad in Genesis 11:26, just before where we are. Here's Abraham, who has, we discover in Genesis 25:1, he remarries after Sarah, his first wife here, dies. He remarries Keturah. At a grand old age, he's a grand old age at that point. You can see it in Genesis 25. And his mistress or servant, who becomes a C is for concubine, M is for marriage. So he has a relationship which is sanctioned by his wife. So that'll be an interesting thing for us to pick up. Those of you that are looking at that chapter, I'm very interested to see what we can apply from that story here, and has Ishmael through this relationship, which leads to descendants coming down this line, which we'll hear about as the story unfolds. And then, of course, has future Isaac through Sarah, which leads down here, goes on to the next chart, which comes down here and leads into the 12 tribes of Israel, headed up by these 12 sons. So you can see, even at the outset of this story, even at the outset of this nation being formed and this family being gathered together, it's not simple and straightforward. There's not, you could say God's purposes aren't quite worked out in the way that he might have thought they should have been or could have been or might wanted them to have been. And we get this word that can be used. I think that God sort of works with us. I'm on tricky ground here in some respects, but God adapts his plans to enable us to work with him or for him to work with us, which I think is a very interesting thing for us to think about. Because we think, I think often, as God being sovereign, God being in control, and God making everything happen the way that he wants it to happen. I don't think that's the story of the Bible. I think the story of the Bible tells us differently to that, that God does have a plan of what he wants to happen, but then actually he works with us to see how that will work out. And we'll come back to that. We'll have a little look at that in just a moment. So you can see this family starting to grow, becomes as numerous as the stars in the sky or the sand in the desert, on the seashore, whatever. You know, this family becomes huge, which is what is promised of Abraham. That he will have many descendants and this nation will be born out of him. I found a little online article. I don't know what we did. What did we do before we had the internet and could go and look for these things? As I was printing this out, I thought, this is great. I'm so pleased I can go and get this. So this is called In the Footsteps of Abraham, and it's by Malachi Martin. And it's from the New York Times archives, which you can go and look at online. And it just sets the setting for what's happening here as we think about Abraham leaving Ur and heading out on his journey, as God says to him, go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you. Ur is a desert scrubland, with miserable ruins jutting from terrain of sand and mud. It is about 120 miles northwest of the Persian Gulf in the country we now call Iraq. Unlikely or not, however, very nearly 40 centuries ago, here began a journey that transcended history and whose arc etched a crescent of hope and faith so indelibly that it determined the motive and course of events for centuries down to this day and far beyond the borders of the nations that were in its path. Places we know as Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and Jordan. The traveller who undertook that momentous journey was Abraham, claimed today as physical ancestor as claimed today as physical ancestor and as, I knew I'd stumble over this word, arch-patriarch of faith and unity by great peoples who, though scattered wide, have long memories. From Ur, Abraham travelled 700 miles to the borders of present-day Iraq, another 700 miles into Syria, another 800 down to Egypt by the inland road, and then back into Canaan, what is now Israel. It is a journey that today's pilgrims, for reasons of international polity, cannot easily replicate. So you get an idea of the distances. 700 miles to the border of present-day Iraq, another 700 miles into Syria, another 800 down into Egypt. That is quite a significant distances, isn't it? For somebody to travel in that day and age, in his era. When Abraham strode upon the stage at Ur, he was already a man of 75. So he's not doing this in his youth. So just if you're thinking, oh, I don't know, I'm hoping that 29 is going to be an easier, quieter year because I'm getting to that stage of life where I just want to chill out. Be encouraged that Abraham started all this at 75. So there could be lots of things that we could step into and might step into this year that we don't necessarily feel we have the energy for at this point, but God will draw us forward.
We
should be doing four times these distances, shouldn't we, our young ages. And Ur was then a capital city of more than 100,000 inhabitants, a place of beauty, grace with towers, palaces, temples, law courts, market squares, statues, shrines, gardens, mosaics, friezes, reliefs, and monuments. This is what he's leaving. It was divided into rectangular blocks and paved streets lined with two-story houses. It had its own seaport and man-made canal giving access to the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean, opening it up to lucrative foreign markets in the areas we call Africa, India, Malaysia, and the Arabian Peninsula. Ur was in fact part of an empire ruled by a written code of law drawn up by King Hammurabi. The civic order and public glory of that empire, Babylonia, were legendary. So this is the setting that Abraham finds himself in, that God calls him away from. And he becomes this traveler, traveling these distances. And as he goes, his family grows. And this nation starts to be built. And as I said before, the key players in God's drama are just like you and I. Let's just pop that off. They're people wrestling with what it's about to follow God. Sometimes getting it right, sometimes I think as we look at the story, getting it rather drastically wrong. It's easy for us to look back, isn't it, and make objective sort of judgments on what they did and what they didn't do. And hopefully as we step into these stories, we'll try and put ourselves in our imagination in their place and wonder what it was like. This idea that Abraham was sort of a nomadic traveler was not something that really was strong in my mind until I started thinking about talking today. And one writer talks about him being a resident alien. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting phrase. That comes up somewhere else, doesn't it? Because we're described as being resident aliens. You know, the New Testament Christians are described as being resident aliens. We're here, but we're not really here. We're here bringing in God's kingdom. We're not connected to the world in the way that perhaps others might be because we're seeing something beyond what we live in. And we're hoping for new and better things, seeing God's kingdom come. And you get several hints of that, but one of the strongest ones is that when Sarah dies in Genesis 23, Abraham has to buy land to bury her. Which is interesting, isn't it? So he doesn't own any land that he can bury his wife in. He has to go and buy a piece of land to bury his wife. That's how disconnected from building something or making something that is his, that he owns, he appears to be. Because he is traveling so much, because he's on the move. It just spoke to me about how much I invest who I am in and where I get my security from is what I own and what I call mine. And here's this guy who's the father of a nation having to buy a bit of land to bury his wife in. Not owning anything, holding everything fairly lightly. I mean, he owned a huge amount because he was a very prosperous guy, but it wasn't in terms of land. Which is sort of interesting, isn't it? When you think of what's now happening in the Middle East about land. That isn't sort of where it started. I thought, oh, that's a bit confusing, really.
Like the Maasai,
yeah, it is. A bit like, yeah, just like the Maasai. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fascinating. So I thought that was really, really interesting insight. And this phrase, this resident alien, and just made me sort of reflect again at the start of a new year, how much am I wedded to or too locked in by the things that are connected to the physical world that I inhabit. And we all are, aren't we, locked into whatever we're doing. And we have to do that. But is that becoming overwhelming and all-encompassing and stopping me from living lightly, living as this resident alien, and having this bigger kingdom perspective? The other thing that comes out that really struck me is I quite like to listen to scripture. So I got some Bluetooth headphones. They were on my Christmas list, and Father Christmas noticed they were there and got them for me. So I popped them on and worked out how to connect them to my computer, which took most of the morning. No, it didn't. It was very easy. And then I thought I'll listen to Genesis chapter 9 through to 17. And it's very, very interesting for me anyway, listening to somebody else reading it rather than actually reading it myself. And so, I mean, if you don't do that, if you've never done that, have a go. There's lots of different versions available on, well, I listen on Bible Gateway, so you can listen to the King James if you want to. Or you can listen to, you know, the Message or the NIV or the Passion or whatever. And you can have it read to you by different people. I quite like the dramatized version, of course, which has music playing in the background and different voices playing, speaking different characters. And one of the things I realized was that Abraham lives and sort of negotiates his way with a lot of the peoples that he ends up rubbing shoulders with as he travels. He lives amicably, as one writer put it, amongst the Canaanites. So we see that in chapter 12, verse 6, with the Perizzites. It's highlighted in chapter 13, verse 7, with the Philistines in chapter 21, verse 34, and the Egyptians, and negotiating with the Hittites in chapter 23. So he sort of works with anybody and everybody. So he's very inclusive. Which again, I thought, that's really, really interesting, isn't it, for us, as we think about how we engage with our world, and particularly with the tensions that we're going to live with over this coming year. How accepting are we going to be? How embracing of other people's views and ideas and cultures are we able to be? And how much should that be part of what we do as Christians? That sense of welcoming people. And when, I guess when you're a traveller, you have to do that, don't you? As he was. You have to negotiate. You have to find your way through. And we see this mix of reliance on God with his desire to want to get things sorted. And the little incident that I talked about earlier, you know, on the chart, where they're unable to have children and they just think, well, just got to make this happen. How can we make this happen? And Sarah says, I know how we can sort this, you know. And, and I just think, how many times do I get into situations where I take back from God what he wants to sort out for me? And how do I notice that? Abraham didn't. Sarah didn't until after the event. So that's another question, I guess, that was raised for me out of looking at this story. And there's a couple of ways of looking at that, aren't there? I suppose there's the God, God, God paradigm, where we believe that God does everything and we do nothing, which I don't think is how it works. He calls us to work with him. And there's the sort of us paradigm, where we just do everything. Or I think there's this God, us, God paradigm, where we partner with God, where we do a certain amount, he does a certain amount, and we work in relationship together, a bit like we do in any of our relationships. And I wonder where you are in that. I wonder whether this last year has mostly been about you in the driving seat and hoping that God doesn't steer you in another direction. Or am I just the only person that thinks like that? Or has it been about you expecting God to do something and not initiating anything yourself? I wonder where you are in that space and where you might want to put yourself in this coming year. Abraham, I think we'll see in the story, sort of fluctuates between those two places. Being surprised by what God does, but then initiating and doing things around what he believes he should do. And then this final little point. So he thought about him being a resident alien, living amicably with the people around him, having this sense of working with God, hearing his voice on occasions and not on others, perhaps in the way that he needed to. And then finally, this his relationship with God, which is, again, not something that we think about in the way that it happens, particularly around Genesis 18, the story about Sodom and Gomorrah, where it appears that Abraham negotiates with God. Well, yeah, but he's sort of, will you really do this? Or can I convince you to do that? And, you know, negotiates the numbers down so that he won't kill righteous people, so that God won't destroy any righteous people. And I'm thinking, wow, Abraham's got quite a cheek, really. And it's done in a really, you know, honouring way. So here we are. So this is, let's read this little bit, because I think it's quite enlightening, really. Genesis 18. Can you imagine yourself having a conversation like this with God? Genesis 18, verse 22. The men turned away and went towards Sodom, but Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Then Abraham approached him and said, "Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing." Can you imagine saying that to God? "To do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? The Lord said, if I find 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, I will spare the whole place for their sake." Then Abraham spoke up again. "Now that I have been so bold," which he has, hasn't he, "as to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ashes, what if the number of righteous is 5 less than 50? Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5 people?" And so he goes on. And I just think it's a lovely insight, isn't it, to this relationship that Abraham has with God. And it sort of pulled me up short in thinking, do I have that sort of relationship with God? Is that the sort of way that I relate to God? Sort of saying, well, hang on a minute, this doesn't seem right. Can I convince you to think about this differently? You know, it's quite strong, isn't it, from his perspective? And it sort of held a mirror up to me, because often I don't think I am like that in the way that I talk to God. So just another challenge for us, which Elizabeth encouraged me to bring, and she handed over to me, so no apologies there. So as we look at this man, this story as it unfolds, I want us to take some of those challenges. What we need to do, I think, as we always need to do with the New Testament, is look at the New Testament through Jesus. So actually, Jesus is our lens. Because there's some things that happen in the Old Testament that we wouldn't want to sign up for. And if we just take it as the literal word of God to us, then we'll be in all sorts of trouble. Believe you me. I'd be in trouble with my wife translating the Hagar story into my marriage. Rest assured, it was, but it is in the Bible. And if you take the Bible literally, you could say, I'm all right. So somehow we need to look at the Old Testament and we need to say, how do we make sense of this? What lens do we look at it through? And I think we need to do what Roger Foster suggests very strongly, which is use what he describes as the Jesus hermeneutic, which is a big word, which my friend Pete, who's studying at the Westminster, what's it called?
Theological Centre.
I can never get it right. Westminster Theological Centre would understand, which is the lens, basically, that you look at it through. So that we have Jesus by our side, sort of whispering in our ear or shining a light on those things that are helpful for us So we see this through him. If you want to explore that idea more, then Greg Boyd has written a fabulous book of how we make sense of some of the things that are really challenging that God appears to do in the Old Testament, which we struggle with. We're not going to get into it now, but so look at Greg Boyd online and find he's done a 2-volume set, which you probably don't want to read, and then he's done a lighter weight version of it, which is just very, very helpful, that says if we look, just trying to think, I think it's called Cross Views, the lightweight version of his thinking. It's really, really helpful if you're one of those people that think, hang on a minute, what happens in the Old Testament somehow doesn't line up with the God that we believe appears in the New Testament in the person of Jesus. And Greg tries to tackle some of those issues. I want to finish with a story, which is sort of connected with what Abraham does, which is gets up and sets off, hears God's voice. And I think this just brought it to life for me. This is a book I've been reading over Christmas, given to me by Pat Kinahan, who has a great way, I've discovered anyway, of finding things that she thinks other people will really enjoy. And I've loved this book. So it's by Bob Goff, and it's called Everybody Always, and it's just full of stories. And here's one of his stories. I have a friend named Lex. He has the same problem in both eyes that I have in one of mine. After 10 failed operations, he lost his eyesight completely when he was about 8 years old. In high school, Lex began to compete in track and field events. By the time he got to college, he figured out he could run like the wind. So we went out for the track team. My first thought was, how can a blind guy run track? Then I found out Lex has a friend. His friend runs in front of Lex and calls his name. Lex just runs towards a voice he knows he can trust. You can see where this is going, can't you? Everyone who runs track and field picks an event. Lex picked the long jump. This still makes my head spin. If you're not familiar with this event, you run as fast as you can down a 3-foot-wide track from a position more than 100 feet away. With your last step, you launch into the air as high as you can from a wooden board in the track and land as far away as you can in a sandpit. Impossible for a blind guy, right? Not for Lex. Do you know why? He's got a friend whose voice he knows he can trust. What Lex does in both simple and impossible at the same time. When it's his turn to compete, his friend squares Lex's shoulders to the sandpit, down the track, then goes to the edge of the pit and starts yelling, "Fly, fly, fly," over and over. Lex runs towards his friend's voice as fast as he can and then jumps as far as he is able. Get this. Lex went out for the US Paralympic team and he made it. He can jump farther than just about anyone in the world. Here's the reason why. People who are becoming love try impossible things because they've surrounded themselves with voices they can trust. At the World Championships, Lex's friend took him to the far end of the narrow track. He squared Lex's shoulders and walked back to the edge of the sandpit. Then he started calling, "Fly, fly, fly," to Lex. Because Lex is blind, he doesn't always run in a straight line. The louder his friend called out to Lex, the more Lex wandered. When Lex got to the end of the track, he leaped into the air with everything he had. The problem? His path had wandered, and he launched crooked. Everyone in the stadium gasped. Lex missed the sandpit entirely and crashed and burned on the concrete. Lex's friend put his hand over his head in disbelief at what had just happened as he ran to his friend's side. Lex was badly bruised. His track uniform was ripped and he was helped off the field for medical attention. We're all a little blind and have a tendency to wander. Sometimes we know what caused us to stop running in a straight line, and other times we don't. We crash and burn and usually don't know what happened. It's what happens next that will tell a lot about who we're becoming. I'm no athlete, but if I were Lex, I would have tempted to quit. I would have been tempted to quit. I would have thought about how unfair my life was. I'd have complained to myself about how I jumped far and hit hard. I might be afraid if it happened once, it might happen again. These are the voices of defeat each of us hears at some point. If we let them, these dissonant voices can drown out the voices we've come to trust in our lives. Lex doesn't see the world this way. His faith doesn't just inform his heart, it informs his whole life. Lex's friend got him a new uniform, so he didn't moon everyone, and Lex walked back onto the field to thunderous applause. Together they walked to the end of the narrow runway. There's a saying in track, last one, best one. His friend squared Lex's shoulders and his feet once again, walked to the edge of the sandpit and called, fly, fly, fly. And as he clapped faster and faster, when Lex hit the board on his 16th step, he leaped into the air like a gazelle. When he hit the sand more than 21 feet later, he won the whole competition. Sure, he strayed a little from the path before. He'd even crashed the last time he tried, but Lex doesn't let fear call the shot in his life, and we shouldn't either. We've all jumped for something we couldn't see, a relationship, a career, even our faith. We've all been beat up too. We've jumped big and missed even bigger. We aim for the soft sand but hit the hard stuff. Here's the thing. God doesn't like us more when we succeed or less when we fail. He delights in our attempts. He gave each of us different abilities too. I can jump over a street curb. Lex can leap over a Buick. I'm not trying to be Lex, and he isn't interested in being me. One thing we do have in common is having a couple of good friends. These friends of ours don't need to give us a lot of instruction either. They just call our names. The promise Jesus made to his friends was simply this. He promised to be a voice they could trust. All he asks his friends to do was to run towards it. Amazing story, isn't it? And the books follow those sorts of stories, which you just think, wow. But there is a point, isn't there? And I guess as we close now and head towards coffee, whose voice are we going to hear? Are we going to hear hundreds of voices in 2019 saying we should do this and we should do that, or we shouldn't have done this or we shouldn't have done that? And even now, as you sit and listen to that story, you will have reconnected with events just as I did, hearing about the gang show and going to watch Bohemian Rhapsody, where you've leapt and failed and crashed. Is that what's going to be determining who you are going to become in 2019? Or are you going to listen to the voice of somebody else encouraging you and calling you on to be the person that God wants you to be? Let's pray together.